probably, you know, I don't know if that's going to be good or bad, and South Korea. Every place is having problems lately. It's not a stable world we live in today.
Okay, the next one is QuickSet Smart Key Decoder. Is a Wi-Fi enabled digital scope? The email that I sent to Dr. Roy, I put the title on it, your lock door, deadbolt, padlock, or any kind of lock using key is no longer safe, and it is true. So in other words, there is a new device, and the device is widely sold, and is sold by QuickSet. And also it is made for QuickSet. Soon we're going to have the same device for anyone. So you have sort of a key that is empty inside, and there is a small, tiny chip camera. And the tiny chip camera allows you to see on your telephone, on your app, all of those lacking surfaces or ports inside of your key lock. And now you can simply flip them, or you can simply make the key based on that. And it even gives you the reading of how the key should look like. So all you need to do is go to the locksmith or go to the Home Depot and make a key. So even though there is advertised for QuickSet, now we can say that anything that uses your key, I assume, but I'm not sure, even key to your car, now is not safe. Maybe Dr. Roy would be able to use better wording to explain that what I'm trying to say. Dr. Roy.
AC2GS. Unfortunately, locks are not pick-proof. None of them are. None of them ever were. The point of the exercise of putting locks and using locks on your doors is not to make it impossible for someone to get into your house, but to make it more difficult to get into your house than your neighbor's house. So that's the whole point of the exercise, just to make it take more time, require more sophistication, but basically any lock, to my knowledge, is pickable if you got the right guy and the right tools. There's a guy on YouTube, I think, called the Lock Picking Lawyer, and he regularly picks locks that are designed to be pick-proof, theoretically. And that device that you mentioned has been available for years. And there's other. There's lots of key-picking tools that are available. I spent some of my misspent youth learning how to pick locks. Some of them are not that difficult. Some of them you need specific tools that are readily available on the internet. You could order bump keys. You could order electronic scramblers that just kind of scramble the pins, and then you just kind of hold them a little bit tight until they get into the slots, and then you open it. There's a lot of different ways of picking locks. So the bottom line, again, locksmiths need these tools, and other people, unfortunately, can buy them as well. You would think that there's some law required that you have to show that you're a legal locksmith in order to get these things, but not particularly, as far as I've seen. So, you know, that's the old adage. Don't assume that your lock is pick-proof. The only reason you're putting the lock on is to make it more difficult to get into your house than your neighbor's house.
Yeah, so the only difference between that which you've learned and that which you saw is that this one is the camera inside of the car, of your key lock. Right. So. It is called smart key, control keys that can see, and you can see on your phone, on the app, what is inside the cylinder and how it is made. And it's real glass mirror that allows the clearest possible image. That's how they advertise that. Now, the next one is, if we have a handheld, and if sometimes we have a problem with reception, it was found, and it was named, the name of it is Red Tail or Tiger Tail, improving reception for handheld radio. Maybe Dr. Roy would explain better what it is. Dr. Roy.
AC2GS. It's a glorified radio. That's all. When a lot of times, someone, if they get themselves a nice and expensive vector network analyzer, one of the things that is not unusual is for people to unscrew the antenna of their handy talkie into a socket and plug it into a vector network analyzer and be aghast at the non-resonance of the whole darn thing. And one of the many reasons is that on a vector network analyzer, you're not taking the consequences of your ground, you're capacitively coupled to your handy talkie, and so that it's like having a radio. You're its radio. So if you replace you with a piece of wire that you call a rat tail, that's what that is. So it's simply offering some degree of grounding to balance your unbalanced whip.
Yeah, so it is actually like a counterpoise. The wires, so when you have the antenna and then you have the inner pin and the outer pin, which is a mass, which is the ground, right? Just go around with the wire around that, not in the center pin. You still have your upper duct antenna and you put a piece of wire on it. So it's a technique used to improve performance of handheld ham transceivers by adding physical counterpoise antenna wire. That wire is also known as a rat tail or tiger tail that connects the antenna connector and provides more effective ground plane that the operator body will act, or in addition to that, the full counterpoise, and this one would be like additional counterpoise. If I answer the problem, Dr. Wood.
Yeah, it's basically, instead of your body being a capacitively coupled counterpoise to the whip element of the antenna, you're replacing it with a much more effective counterpoise as a real piece of wire dangling on the ground aspect of the connection. That's all it amounts to. It's been around for years and years and years. It gets kind of messy because now you got a wire kind of trailing off, whereas, you know, if you could do without it, it's a little bit more compact to not have wires kind of falling away from your antenna mount.
The next antenna is real portable EFHF antenna. So actually, imagine that you have a roller that has roller. It's small, tiny cylinder in the plastic enclosure. And then you have a two sides of a dipole winded on it. Now, what you could do is, you can unwind all of those arms from the roller, so when the antenna is in the position of being carried on, then you have just a roller in a plastic enclosure. And when you need to unroll this antenna for 20 meters, 40 meters, 80 meters, whatsoever, you just either pull one of the arms of the dipole, and the other one will unwind as well, or just use the handle to unwind. Dr. Roy, maybe you could do it better.
Not really. I mean, it's an interesting, you know, all these kind of complicated designs. I'm not quite sure what the ultimate benefit is. I'd love to have a comparison to just a standard N-fed half-wave antenna and these things that you roll out and then you have to resize them, I guess, depending upon what you're planning to use it for. You know, some antenna designs tend to be a wee bit too clever for their own good.
Yeah, I understand that we have on the piece of small cylinder, let's say 3 inches long and 3 inches wide, we have two pieces of the very thin wire winded counterclockwise. So when you start to unwind one, the other one is unwinding as well. When you're trying to wind them both, both of them are winding on this piece of cylinder. And then it's in the enclosure. So it looks like a leash for the dog. Leash for the dog, the only thing is that leash for the dog is one side of the dipole. And now imagine that you have a leash for the dog that has two arms, like for two dogs, from the opposite side. And that winds itself because of the spring and unwinds itself. So it's extremely good portable antenna for unique needs and to experience.
Okay, I think it's all down to those last few words for unique needs.
Yeah, of course. Now, another antenna is G5RV. G5RV, that was interesting antenna that was invented by G5RV in 1946. And it was supposed to be a 20 meters antenna, but ham radio amateurs made it from 3.5 to 30 megahertz. And it is extremely inexpensive antenna. So the original, the dipole limits were 15.55 meters, which is 51 feet long, each one. And there was impedance matching symmetric feed line, leader line, or twin LED that was either 300 ohms or 450 ohms. And in general, the case for the electric antennas, the height of the G5RV over the ground was approximately 30 feet. The impedance was 50 ohms. That antenna was working amazingly good in most of the bands, but it wasn't that easy to tune. That antenna in DX Engineering cost $89.95 with coax. Without the coax, with the feed line and two arms for the dipole and the isolator and to XGS. Okay. Now the next one is W3DGG. This antenna has a balloon. It's easy to build an extremely high performance antenna, works perfectly on HF bands from 3.5 to 28 megahertz. With some compromises. It is basically half-wave dipole for 40 and 80 meters, and the LC circuits or trap 40 meters allows you to use it for single radiating. End of quote. I'm trying to wrap, but actually I had this antenna for a number of years. It was working fairly good in all of the bands, but it wasn't working good, really good. But if you had a good antenna tuner, you could use it in all of the bands. The antenna is also very much inexpensive. You actually have a two traps on each one of the arms, tuned to 7 megahertz, and that's all. The last antenna I would like to talk about is Buckmaster. It's only 4 bands, but it's 3,000 watts for people who would like to have a good amplifier. It's 40, 20, 10, and 6 meters. And the last thing I have purchased because Dr. Roy was talking to us and he said a few times that he has the VNA, Nano VNA, have a number of good quality VNAs, but they are heavy and very expensive, thousands of dollars. So I decided to buy myself VNA that is from 50 kilohertz to 3 gigahertz and is 4 inches display. Actually, mine is 5.7 gigahertz, I believe. But after I bought it and I paid for it $98.79 with the N connectors and with the open close and with the three calibration connectors, okay. Then I found that I did it wrong because there is another one that is 7 inches. So not only right now the difference is that you're not dealing with the tiny, tiny connectors that they are very fragile and you could damage that VNA of yours, but you could use it already made with N connectors. And it is your choice to use the 7-inch or 4-inch screen. Back to you, Dr. Reich.
Okay, very good. Basically, I bought that VNA about a year and a half ago, 4 inches. I didn't see it. They were offering 7 inches this time. And I like the N connectors because I like N connectors in general, and there's a lot less problems with strain relief. If you get the ones that are SMA and you can use an adapter for N and use N connectors, it's very easy to snap that thing right off. So having them soldered in an N connector on both of the ports, I find, is much better. If I need to use SMA, I could always use an adapter. It's a much more mechanically sturdy thing. 7 inches is nice, but you know, sometimes too much of a good thing is too much. The beauty of things like the Nano VNA is if you have a computer nearby, and I almost always have a computer nearby, you can plug in the USB connection, run a Python scripted software, and basically run a very big screen, as big as your monitor is, of the front of your VNA. So if 4 inches isn't enough, you could boost it up to 34 inches if you have a display like that. So it's a nice thing. It's very inexpensive. You know, back in the old days, companies would charge you $20,000-$30,000 for a good VNA, and it would weigh a ton. You know, we live in glorious times, so avail yourself of it. You know, I have a little spectrum analyzer. I have a little VNA. You know, they're not going to amaze commercial companies who spend thousands of dollars for these things, but then they got thousands of dollars to throw away.
And now you need only spectrum analyzer for it. Actually, that unit comes with open, close, and 50 ohms, so everything that is needed for calibration. I didn't put my R5 RG yet because I wasn't on HF for a long period of time, but I bought it and I have a good coax for it. Already sent from DX Engineering to me. It was not much money to be spent, and I hope next week I'm going to be on HF as well. So I hope I would be able to join the TechNet from Dr. Roy at 28 megahertz. Back to you.
Yeah, you mean the 10-meter net. It's not the TechNet. Well, I mean, we discuss all kinds of things, but it's the 10-meter net. It's 28.380 or nearby. I'd love to hear you there, Wesley. I have the spectrum analyzer. I had the old one that only went up to, what, something like 500 or 600 megahertz, and I got envious of it being able to capture 5 gigahertz. I could check out my Wi-Fi systems and such. You know what you have to do to enable it to be able to do spectrum analysis in the gigahertz?
Go ahead.
You have to go to a special page, and then you have to go to the website and look it up, and you have to press the numbers 4321. That's how you get enabled into the ultra mode.
Okay. the package didn't arrive yet. It's scheduled at 2 days from now, at 10, 2 days from now. Okay. I didn't get the package yet. When I get the package, I'm going to contact Dr. Voy and ask him for advice. I have probably 3 or 4 VNAs in here and at least 2 spectrum analyzers, but there's 50 pounds each one and let's say $10,000. I'm not going to risk it. So that VNA is actually what I need. And to exchange.
Okay, have fun, enjoy. I mean, that's one of the benefits. People will do things with $100-plus equipment that they wouldn't even think twice about doing for a $10,000 piece of equipment. So enjoy it, and enjoy the 21st century. And you guys out there, I'm telling you, if you're so inclined, if you're at all curious of how your antennas are working, this is one of the better ways of checking it out. You can hook it up to the transmission line and scan it across the frequencies you're curious about and see where it's resonant and where it's not resonant, and you can follow up on it. For a time when I was a little bit more obsessive compulsive, I would run scans every other month to make sure that my antennas were operating according to the way they did when I set it up. So take advantage of these low-priced things, especially before tariffs come on. You know, the price of things might be going up, so yeah, consider that as well. Anyway, Wes, is that all the subjects tonight, I think?
Yes, it is. Thank you very much. Have a good night, and it's time for Paul. ACTPL on quick thing.
Yeah, Jeff?
Just the model of the little handheld Chinese analyzer that I use is a November 2061 SA. That's November 2061 SA. It's the one with the SMA connectors, but it goes from HF all the way up to 1.3 gigahertz. Really nice unit. AC2PL.
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising. I don't think I've bumped into anyone. There's always the possibility that it's manufactured in a real rundown factory, doing a clone and doing it badly, but I haven't bumped into anyone. These particular Chinese, you should always kind of buy this through reputable means, but yeah, they're really fun to use. Sometimes you get inexpensive things and they're just built cheaply and they look cheap and it just doesn't feel like that much fun. But it's a lot of fun playing with these little underpriced units. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and I thank everyone who participated tonight. I hope you learned things, and I hope you had a good time. And I hope you join us next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we do this all over again. But now it is time for Paul WS2N. With the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS, WS2N. Good net tonight, Roy. And, I was listening to you before about the hydrogen frequency. That's what it is. And I think Wesley was pretty much talking about the water frequency with the microwaves. So, yeah, that's different. That's roughly 2.4, where the hydrogen is the 1.420 gigahertz. Anyway, India last week launched a rocket. They have 2 good-sized rockets that they use. They have the geosynchronous one big rocket that they use for heavy lift vehicles, but then they have the medium lift vehicle, which is they call it the polar satellite launch vehicle or the PSLV, and that's the one they launched a couple of days ago with two satellites on board, but they're used together. The idea is to create their own solar eclipse, an artificial solar eclipse. So they have this coronagraph, and that thing's going to open up, they say 1.4 meters, yeah, so 4 or 5 feet. This thing's going to open up, and then it's going to sit around the distance of a football field, a little bit longer than that, away from the occulta, and that occulta will pick up the light from the sun. It's going to be right in front of the sun, and it's going to be able to make its own eclipse for hours at a time, you know. It's not like on Earth where, you know, you get a couple of minutes and they're happy with it. This thing's going to last for hours, and the way they do that is they're going to send it on an extremely high elliptical orbit, and it's in that orbit now, roughly around 40,000 miles away from Earth, and then it comes very close to Earth. And it takes 20 hours to make one orbit, where, you know, if you're in low Earth orbit, it takes you about 90 minutes. So this thing is, so far from what I heard, mechanically, and everything's working. But it'll take a while before they get results from this particular launch. It weighs a couple of thousand. Well, I think it's around 1,200 pounds. So the combined setup of the occulta and the coronagraph. So I'm anxious to see how this thing's going to work out. I know we have plans on eventually doing something like this in the future, a very large one, you know. This thing's like 5-6 feet in diameter, and we plan on doing one with, 30-50 feet in diameter. We have long-term plans, but I'm not going to hold my breath for that. Science missions, I think, are going to be curtailed for a couple of years. Going to probably really push man flights in the future. We'll see. I think they're going to get a lot of results from this in India, compared to some of the rocket launches that we have. I thought this was pretty interesting. Let's stand by to see if anybody had any questions about this or anything else. WS2N.
Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform. Well, good evening.
Hi, Charlie. Hi, how are you? Good evening to you. And, what's new with you? You're still planning on going down to see a real launch?
Yes, I plan on going down on the 10th, and they got a Mars mission going on the 11th, I believe.
I don't know if there's a Mars mission. I haven't heard that one. So, what, they got a satellite going up to Mars? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I'll have to look into that. That doesn't ring a bell. I know they have plans on launching in, that would be toward the end of December. That would be a Blue Origin mission. I don't know if that's going to get off in December at all. It's not the New Glenn mission. From what I understand, that's been delayed. And that was originally going to be a Mars mission. They were going to send Escapade, two Earth satellites to Mars. But now, from what I understand, that's delayed until sometime early next year. So do you know any more information about this particular launch? What rocket is it? Is it a SpaceX Falcon 9, or is it a Blue Origin New Glenn rocket? Or is it a... let's see. It wouldn't be a Vulcan rocket. I don't think they have a planned launch for December.
I'd have to look that up. But they have satellites going up now where you can make a direct call from one person to another, from Earth to a satellite and back down direct.
They're getting close to it. Voice is a ways away. They plan on having the ones that are going up on Starlink to have the capability of, you know, sending text up and down on your phone. But I don't think that's in operation yet. I know it's in the very near future, but telephone calls, you know. Voice is going to be a ways away. I'm not expecting that anytime soon. You know, maybe next year or something. Back to you, John.
Today at 12:12 a.m., they had a Falcon launch with 23 satellites with 13 direct cell call capabilities.
Yeah, the direct cell, I know that out of the 23 satellites, some of them are going to have that capability, but they're not going to activate that until they get an okay from the FCC and the powers to be. But I think the first ones are going to, the first time they put it into operation, it's going to be just text. Charlie, as far as I heard. So we'll see. They're getting there. There's other companies that are involved with this as well. There's another company that's putting up a set of satellites for the Internet of Things, just things, you know, equipment, transmitting and receiving, you know. That has nothing to do with people. The Internet of Things is another constellation that they're putting up, but that's not SpaceX, that's somebody else. We'll see. Anyway, I just wanted to talk about the NASA news conference that they had on just last week as well. Let me drop it. NASA had a news conference. They talked about one of the, as far as I'm concerned, important thing dealing with manned flight is the Orion spacecraft. A little over a year ago, they had the Orion spacecraft was sent around the moon and came back on a 25-day mission launched by the Space Launch System. And they were testing everything, making sure that this Orion spacecraft would be capable of handling four people going to the moon and back. And everything, you know, checked out from what I see 100% as far as the, you know, inside the spacecraft is concerned. One of the things that they really wanted to test is the heat shield as it comes through the atmosphere at roughly 25,000 miles per hour. When you normally deorbit from Earth orbit, let's say from the ISS, you come through at 17,500 miles an hour. And usually you heat up to around almost 4,000 degrees. And that's been very successful. But this comes back to 25,000 miles an hour, and it heats up to, you know, maybe over 5,000 degrees. And, you know, it landed successfully in the Pacific Ocean on Artemis 1, or the Orion spacecraft itself. And if there was a crew on board, they would have survived, no problem. But the heat shield itself started to ablate more than was planned. They used something called Avcoat. Avcoat is material that they use, and they figured out that when they looked at it, they could see that pieces of it like broke off, and that's not supposed to happen. So it took them all this time, since the splash pad, to figure out what the problem was. So Avcoat apparently has, it's got gas molecules inside of it that expanded. They thought that the gas molecules should have been dissipated, after they put it on, for a period of time. But apparently, they didn't leave it long enough, or whatever. They might have needed to treat it differently. But anyway, when it came through at 25,000 miles an hour and heated up to 5,000 degrees, these molecules expanded, popping certain parts of that heat shield. And I saw pictures of it. You can see it's all more than charred. There's actual pieces that are missing. So they figured out what to do about it, and it had to do with the way they re-enter the atmosphere. There's two ways to re-enter an atmosphere with these type of vehicles. Naturally, it doesn't have wings, it's just got a heat shield. This round heat shield. So there's two ways that you come through. One is a ballistic shot, straight on through, right down to the ground or to the ocean. Or the other type is where they skip along the atmosphere. They come in, hit the atmosphere, they come down a little bit, and then they skim back out to space, and then they come back down again. They like doing that because there's less heating of the heat shield. But the bad thing about it in this case was when they skipped back up, that the pressure reduced around it, allowing the Avcoat molecules inside to expand and pop the piece of the heat shield. So, they have to work on that. They really like to continue to do that. That's the standard way of coming through. The Russians like to do that as well, but a couple of times that they've re-entered the atmosphere, including one time a couple of years ago when Nick Hague was one of the astronauts on board the Russian spacecraft, the solid boosters, that attached to Soyuz rocket, one of them hit the core stage, and that created an abort. The launch abort system activated and pulled the Soyuz spacecraft away from the core stage, and the crew eventually reentered. But they came down in a ballistic fashion, which is, they tend to have a rough ride and a little bit hard landing when they do come down, which is what happened to them. It's also happened to a couple of other flights that they've had years ago before they perfected the reentry system. So they'd rather have the skip type of reentry. All the vehicles, the Chinese, when they come down, and the Orion spacecraft, even all the SpaceX missions, when they come back, either the cargo version or the manned version, they like to have the skip type of re-entry. But they're going to have to do something with this Orion heat shield. They already know the cure. There's two more that are being developed right now. for Artemis 2 and Artemis 3. And they said that they're performing corrective measures, whatever that might be. So this way they should be able to launch the crew. By the way, the plan was to launch next year in September. They're going to have to actually wait probably until spring of the following year. You know, not 2025, but probably the spring of 2026 to launch the crew of four to go around the moon and come back. Now, of course, this all might change. You have a new administration coming in, and so all bets are off. I think they're going to concentrate more on manned missions, so that should help. But I think they're going to back off on scientific missions, which to me is very concerning. You know, they have the Dragonfly mission that's planned on going to Titan, around that moon around Saturn. That could be in jeopardy. A lot of climate missions could be also in jeopardy. That's usually what happens when the Republicans take over. First time I remember that happening was when Al Gore lost. And yet Bush took over, and that administration decided to cancel one of Al Gore's pet projects, which was a mission that was going to go out to L1, the one closest to the sun. Anyway, that mission was canceled, and then years later, when the Democrats came back to office, they took it out of mothballs and called it the Discover mission, and brought it back to life, with more modern technology attached to it. But that's what usually happens. Well, we're going to have to wait and see. They're going to have a new administrator. The guy that they want to appoint, he has to be confirmed, is this fellow Jared Isaacman. He's flown two times before, not really for NASA, but for SpaceX. He was the guy that was instrumental in, they call it Inspiration 4 mission, where he took three other people up with him. Didn't go to the International Space Station. That was not approved by NASA. They orbited the Earth for a couple days and returned safely. So that worked out okay, which was a good mission for St. Jude, by the way. They raised over $200 million for that, for that hospital. So then as time went on, just recently, a couple months ago, he went up again. They call it the Polaris mission. So again, Jared Isaacman was the commander of that. Took three other people with him. One fellow and two women. And he performed the first spacewalk by a commercial crew. Nothing to do with NASA. He kind of went half out of, he didn't float out of the spacecraft like Ed White did. And, on the Gemini 4 mission. Ed White actually floated out on an umbilical. Jared was on an umbilical, but he stood up and then eventually came back, and eventually one of the women did the same thing. But that was a few months ago. And Now he's become very well known, and it looks like he's probably going to be the choice for the next administration for NASA administrator, replacing Bill Nelson, who of course is also an astronaut. He was a senator for many years, and before that he was a congressman. And when he was congressman, he went up on a space shuttle. We'll see how the future looks. Your guess is going to be as good as mine of what's going to happen. Some people talking about doing something with the SLS program, the Space Launch System itself, because that thing's way over budget. I just don't see that being canceled. There's too many states across the country that are invested in that. There's plenty of people employed by keeping the SLS program going. So we'll see. I really don't think too much is going to change over the next couple of years. But we're going to see. Any comments? WS2X.
WB2BXL.
WB2BXL. Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember, during Trump 1, so to speak, he desperately wanted NASA to do a crewed Mars mission and he offered them unlimited money to do it, and they said it just couldn't be done. And if I remember correctly, Elon Musk says he can do at least some kind of Mars mission within the next 4 years. So it would not surprise me that the idea here is for Isaacman to scarf up all the money he can and give it to Elon Musk to do a Mars mission under the NASA banner. I also suspect he'll try to kick off one of the regular astronauts and do an ISS flight himself, but I don't know if he'll get away with that one. I think you make a good case for saying he won't get away with any of what he wants to do. That's possible also, but, these people don't follow the normal rules. WB2BXO.
Okay, yeah, I could see that happening. But this rocket that he's building isn't anywhere near ready, you know? They haven't even made it to orbit yet. I mean, it's a big accomplishment to get this monster off the ground and, eventually try to reuse it. But they're still a long ways off, I think. He's got all the money in the world right now, and he still hasn't done it. So he's got $250 billion that he could play with. And NASA only has one-tenth of that for a budget. NASA's whole budget is $25 billion. So that includes the SLS, the $4 billion to keep the ISS going, money for the X-59 they're working on the experimental plane that will eventually be able to go faster than the speed of sound over land without making a loud sonic boom. They're involved with the NEMO project where people go underwater for weeks at a time to see what it's like to be cooped up in a situation like that, 60 feet underwater. They've got balloon missions that they do all the time from Antarctica and different places around the world. The robotic missions throughout the solar system are all being funded by this $25 billion per year. So, you know, they got their hands full. And even if they take half that money and pour it to Elon Musk's rockets, I mean, it's not gonna add that much to Elon Musk to get anything else further done. I think he's doing whatever he can. I mean, he built a whole town down there in Boca Chica, in Texas, and you know. He's going as fast as he can with or without NASA. And I think they're a long way from going to Mars. I don't think so. They might say they're going to do that. And that's the problem with different administrations. They have the Constellation program with Bush. And then that got canceled because it wasn't progressing properly, and it would have been way over budget. So they said, you know, the Constellation program was supposed to be where they were going to go to the moon. They had the lander plan, it was called Alpha. They canceled all that, and then they decided, well, we're going to pick our asteroid out in space, we're going to put that asteroid around the moon, and we're going to, you know, land on that, and we're going to have a crew go out and take pieces of this asteroid that's in orbit around the moon and bring it back to Earth. That all got canceled. And they said, well, we're going to go to Mars, you know, and they were thinking about Mars was going to be next. Forget about the moon. We've been there, done that. I remember that during the Obama administration. Well, that got changed eventually. Go to the moon. Now, you know, all bets are on the moon. What are they going to do now? You said, Frank, they're going to go back to Mars? Give me a break. Meanwhile, it's the same equipment that they're building, you know, the same space launch system has been on the drawing boards. $10 billion plus now. The Orion spacecraft has definitely been on the drawing board longer than that. And yet, you know, we still haven't landed on the moon. We better go to the moon first, because I don't want, I said this years ago, I don't want China landing there first, finding one of our rovers, putting we have three rovers right that are on the moon, manned rovers, going up there, land somewhere near Apollo, either 15, 16, or 17, bringing a couple of batteries, putting in a rover and driving it around, you know? Of course, I'm always kidding around about that, but I don't know, I'm not too far from the truth. We don't want them riding around on the moon. We want to be up there before they are, on a regular basis. Anything else, Frank, back to you.
Yeah, well, I think the entire thing is now going to be ego and national pride driven, and not science or engineering driven. So I think if somebody can convince them that we need to do the moon mission to beat the Chinese, it's possible that the administration will decide that, oh, okay, we'll do that rather than trying to go to Mars first. But in any case, my guess would be that despite the enormous pork barrel involved in SLS, that the administration is going to trash that program and outsource the whole thing to their buddy Elon. But that's just my guess for whatever it's worth. Go ahead.
Yeah, can you imagine Boeing and Lockheed? All these other companies that are involved with SLS, Grumman, they're the ones that build the Northrop Grumman build the solid booster rockets for that thing. Each one is 3.5 million pounds of thrust. You know, they'd have to write them off. Wow, I just don't see it happening. They're up in they test that up in Utah. There's dozens of locations around the country that are involved with SLS. The congressmen are not going to let that happen. And they're the ones that, you know, are in charge of the purse strings, from what I see. Anyway, Frank, I heard Charlie wanted to say something. He was getting late. So let me go over to Charlie. Back to you. WSLS.
Yeah, I got a question about why are they going just to just to go around the moon? I can't see that concept. If they're going to land and build something, yes. But just going to go there and back?
They don't want to test out everything, including the spacecraft itself, with the crew, and make sure everything that they have planned right up until they call for docking with another spacecraft. By the way, they have to dock with another spacecraft. The Orion will not land on the moon, so they have to dock with another spacecraft that's going to take them down to the moon. Then they can do their thing for, you know, a couple of few days and then come back up with that same spacecraft, redock to the Orion spacecraft and come back. Well, that rocket is nowhere near ready. But even if it was, they want to more or less duplicate what they did in the Apollo days when Apollo 8 went around the moon successfully without the LEM and then came back and landed back on Earth. And then, you know, they went through different ways of testing before they actually landed on the moon. Then Apollo 9, that was, let's test that LEM, but let's not go to the moon. Let's test it in Earth orbit in case something goes wrong. That's what they did. Apollo went up and with the LEM and everything went fine on Apollo 9. That checked out okay. And they said, well, what are we going to do now? Now we've got Apollo 10. Do we really want Apollo 10? And they said, no, let's go actually to the moon, orbit the moon. We'll separate the Apollo vehicle with the LEM. And in fact, we're going to fly very far apart where they couldn't even see each other. And that's what they did on that mission, Apollo 10. Eventually, you know, they did everything. They did duplicated what they were going to do right before landing. All they had to do was, you know, ignite the rocket engine to slow them down, and they would have landed. But that was not the plan. Let's make sure all this other stuff works. You know, undocking and docking in lunar orbit. So they did that, and then they returned to Earth. It wasn't until the next mission, Apollo 11, that they actually did everything that Apollo 10 did. The only difference is they fired that engine, slowed themselves down, and actually landed on the moon. So that's what happened anyway, Charlie. I'm looking at the time. We're going to be closing now. But back to you for any comments.
Thank you for that information.
And yeah, very good, 73.
The thing
I see is that Isaac Mint is at least an experienced astronaut, despite his huge ego and the huge amount of money he threw at the thing to get to do it. He did two space missions, including a very risky second mission, without getting himself or anybody else killed. So the guy has some respect for rules and procedures and, you know, knows how things are done reasonably safely. So that's about the most hopeful thing I can say. Have a good night, WB2BXO.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, but you know, I spent my life in construction, and you know, you'd work for different people, you know, different foremen that were in charge. And,